Okay, so good morning everybody. Welcome to the fourth workshop on Karma and Rebirth in Early Buddhism held here at the Buddhist Library. And as always, thanks so much to the good folk at the Buddhist Library for giving us the use of their venue. And I'll just begin as usual by giving a short summary and background to where we've come so far. We began the course by looking at doing some myth busting with karma and rebirth, right? Looking at some of the different ways that notions of karma and rebirth are presented in popular culture especially, and seeing whether they had any basis in what the Buddha taught. And we found that most of the time they're not. And it's a curious thing that the teachings on karma, which I think are very simple and very beautiful, but they seem to be so widely misunderstood throughout the Buddhist world. So the second workshop, we looked at something more to do with the historical context. We looked at the beliefs that were present in India before the time of the Buddha, the different spectrum of beliefs, how the Buddha responded to those, and what the meaning of the teaching of karma and rebirth was within that context. And we saw that in the Buddha's day, much like today, there was a huge amount of diversity, different kinds of views, different people believing and teaching and practicing different kinds of things. And it certainly was very far from being a monolithic orthodoxy, and certainly not everybody believed in karma and rebirth at that time. And then in the last workshop, the third workshop, we looked at more specifically the Buddha's teachings on karma and rebirth, and we did a survey of some of the more important suttas that talk about karma and rebirth from the early Buddhist texts. And even though as such a major topic, there are so many suttas that cover the ground, we tried to sort of focus on some of the core teachings to get a grounding on what the Buddha actually taught about it. For this week, we're going to be looking at the evidence for rebirth, perhaps evidence against it as well. And we're going to be considering whether these things are true. It's one thing to say that the Buddha taught something, one thing to say it's found in the suttas, but it's another thing to say that it's true. And one of the basic principles that's found in the early Buddhist texts, as we've mentioned many times, is that the Buddha said that you should test and inquire about what he said, right? So the idea that we should blindly believe everything which is found in the early texts is very, very far from the spirit of how the Buddha taught. So one of the things which I think is a little bit disappointing in Buddhist cultures and Buddhist traditions today is that there seems to be relatively little of that spirit remaining. And within Buddhist cultures, people often accept these things like rebirth and so on very uncritically, very dogmatically, without investigating them. And I think one of the problems with that attitude is that it promotes almost the opposite attitude of like an uncritical and dogmatic rejection of the notion of karma and rebirth. And this is something we also find very, very commonly. And very rarely do we find like a careful examination of the evidence. And this is what we want to try to do for this week and this workshop. Now, there's a lot of material to cover today. So that's as it is. It's just a broad topic. I will try to speak relatively little this workshop, and we've got some videos and these kinds of things, so we should have some, hopefully some fun looking at those things. One thing I would like to throw out now, and I'll just get you to think about it, is that I would very much like it if we had some first-person testimonials during this workshop, okay? So if any of you have had any memories of past lives, any experiences like that, or if you know somebody who's had such experiences, then I would really appreciate it if you shared it. I know that sometimes these things are quite personal, they're quite private, and you don't really, you know, feel like sharing it. So, you know, that's fine. If you don't want to share it, that's perfectly okay. You shouldn't feel under any pressure to share it. I mean, just because the fact that if you share it, you might be opening the path to Nibbana for many people, okay? And if you keep it to yourself, you know, because of your own lack of courage and insecurities, then you shouldn't feel... No, I'm only kidding around, okay? Don't feel like that. If you feel comfortable to share, then that would be lovely, right? But, yeah. So, and just for... Just again, just a little bit of background on it. I've mentioned our Sutta Central and the discourse platform that we're using with Sutta Central, and this has been developing quite nicely, and we've got quite a nice conversation happening on there, and people have been asking different questions about the Buddhist texts, about the workshops, and these kinds of things. And so if you're interested to look at some of these things outside of the framework of the course, then please go to discourse.suttacentral.net. And join in the conversation there. Okay, and I have a little promotional thing, and you see the flyers here. We've finally managed to get our sort of central development trust set up, thanks to the hard work of Deepika, who has done all of the paperwork, all of the boring stuff. And so thank you so much to her for putting that together and making it possible for us to collect donations and do some fundraising to make sort of central work. The chanting that you heard as you came in was the chanting by Damaruan, who many of you may know as the Sri Lankan chanting boy. And we're going to be looking a little bit more at his chanting later on. But just in brief, when he was very young, he would chant for hours at a time in Pali. And some of those chantings were recorded, so we get the chance to actually hear that. Okay, so let's with the slides. This is a little photo of Professor Ian Stevenson, and we chose this as the kind of the theme for it because Ian Stevenson's probably the greatest example in modern times of somebody who has put a lot of effort, a lot of time into very carefully and critically raising up the question of rebirth, and he's been perhaps more than anybody else responsible for reinvigorating a discussion of these questions within the academic world. Okay, So why should we be looking for evidence? Shouldn't it be enough for us if we're practicing Dhamma or something like that, we can just do it? Or if we don't, even if you don't believe in rebirth, well, you can still be mindful and you can still practice and so on. So why are we bothering looking for evidence? Hopefully I don't have to spend too much time on this because I should think that the question's answered largely in the earlier workshops. Our first part point is that rebirth matters. And contrary to people who say, look, it doesn't really matter whether you get reborn or not, it does matter. It makes a big difference in your life. What is the meaning of your life? How are you living? All of these things. And the Buddha put the question of rebirth as very central in his teachings. So to argue that we can just remove all of those hundreds and hundreds of references to rebirth in the core Buddhist teachings, I think is a bit silly. It matters. It matters what happens to you. Where does the choices we make, the actions we do they last? Do they have any effect, or do they just disappear? Right? It matters. It makes a difference. How it matters is up to you, right? So the facts don't determine meaning, right? But they surely should influence the meaning. Yeah? So different people might come to a belief or a not belief in rebirth or whatever, and they might respond to that in different ways. They surely will respond to it in different ways. Right? So it's not about saying that you have to respond to it in a certain way, but it's just about understanding that we should know what this thing is, what this life is. The other reason we look for evidence is because proving things is hard, okay? It's hard work, and this is why, people really often fall back on blind belief and things like that, the authority of a guru, or this is what the tradition says, or something like that. That's easy, right? It's easy to just keep saying the same thing that everybody else says. But investigation is hard. Finding evidence is hard. Sifting out reliable facts from all of the stories and things is hard. Right? So we it's something that we should put some time and effort into. Another reason to look for evidence, empirical research is the basic method of the suttas. Okay, in the suttas, all constantly the suttas are coming back to what is your experience. Yeah, the eye is impermanent, forms are impermanent, eye consciousness is impermanent. You're looking at experience all the time. And the basic method of the suttas is to come back and stay close to what we know to be true. Right? So in some senses, the kind of evidence that we're going to be looking for is different from the kind of evidence which is available in the suttas, okay? Of course, they didn't have historical records in the time of the Buddha. So the notion of history as we think of it today, right, was only just being born. Okay? It didn't really exist consciously at that time. Because if you think about it, you can't really have a notion of history until you have a way of checking your historical facts, right? Otherwise, all you have is stories, right? And you have competing stories. But when you have like archaeology, or you have like records and so on, you written accounts or something, you can say someone has this story, is that true? And you can say, what are the facts? And then you can get this notion of history which evolves as like a study of the past. In the Buddha's time, that didn't exist. They didn't have the means of doing that, right? So that the kinds of research that we're looking at are in some cases different kinds of things, but they're still very much in the spirit of that empirical inquiry. Now, one important point is that there's a difference between a personal evidence and a cultural evidence. Okay? Now you can verify, the main method of investigating and verifying rebirth in the suttas is through meditation. Right? So you go away, you meditate, you see the past lives or whatever, and you let go of them, you get enlightened. Whoop-de-doo. Okay? Fantastic, right? There you go, you're enlightened. That's great for you, but of course it means nothing to anybody else, right? I mean, maybe people might be influenced by your personal charisma, or they might believe the stories that you say. But in terms of like a cultural discourse, the fact that somebody personally attests to these truths is basically pretty much meaningless. So this is why we evolved in a cultural discourse a different kind of sets of evidence. Okay, and so these are the kinds of evidence which we're going to be looking at, in addition to the more specifically meditative or spiritual kind of evidence. So here are some kinds of evidence which have been brought up in the context of believing in karma and rebirth, especially in modern times. Okay, the first one is reliance on authority. Right, so we believe something because the Buddha said so or something. I mean, authority doesn't have to be an absolute, right? Doesn't mean that so-and-so said something, therefore it's right, okay? But, you know, if Einstein says something about, you know, the theory of relativity, you're going to take it seriously, right? It doesn't mean he's always right, but it does mean that you're going to pay careful attention to what they said. So this is the voice of authority, the experience of savants, of people who are young children and so on, who have extraordinary abilities, near-death experiences, right? You die and leave your body, go off and into the light and so on. Various forms of memories, right? People can have either people have spontaneous memories, or they might do like hypnotic regression. Especially children can have a lot of memories, and also through meditation. So this is another source of evidence and knowledge. And of course, you know, it should not need saying that memory is very unreliable. And that any kind of evidence which bases itself on memory needs to be investigated very carefully and very cautiously before you take it at all seriously. I don't know if you remember about a while ago now, 10, 15 years ago when I was living in Perth, there was a famous legal case with a politician at the time, Carmen Lawrence, who was accused of doing this kind of misconduct. And she said, I didn't remember it. And as evidence for her trial was her like university thesis, which was all about how fallible memory was, right? So she managed to submit this as evidence for her case. Oh, yeah, see, I would always be saying how bad memory was. It's actually a good field of study for politicians to do in the, yeah. So, but it's true, right? We can't remember what we had. I tried to remember what I had for breakfast this morning, right? I can remember some of it. I couldn't necessarily remember all of it. So how are we going to remember what's happened in past lives? Biology is a very important one, and this is the one which was really brought to the fore by Ian Stevenson. There are a number of cases, physical characteristics of people who are born which match with remembered past life experiences. Okay, a classic example might be somebody who has a birthmark over their heart, and then when they see the photograph of the body of the person from a previous life, then they were shot and they had a bullet wound which has the same color, the same size, and that same thing. Yeah? So this kind of case, I think, is very, very difficult to explain in any other way than through rebirth stories. There are some remarkable kinds of ones. There's one story of somebody who had remembered their life where they were, they died, well, I think they'd been like kidnapped or something like that and tied up in a cupboard or something like that and tied up with ropes and they'd just been left to die there. Very traumatic death. And when they were born, they could remember this when they were young and they had a very curious birthmark, which was like an indentation around their wrist where you could actually see the striations of the rope marks in the skin, right? And so these are the kinds of things which, again, you're struggling to find any other kind of explanation, especially when they're then confirmed independently, when you can actually confirm that the events happen. So biology. And the last kind of evidence, which for me actually personally is perhaps the most convincing of all, and that is just ordinary everyday learning. We'll come back to that in a minute. Okay, so I'll go through and we'll have a look at some of these different kinds of evidence. So the first one, from authority, the Buddha. I won't spend a lot of time talking about the Buddha's ideas about karma and rebirth because that's what we've spent our time with already on the course and we will do again in the next workshop. But just to reiterate, in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which we just heard Dhammaruan chanting, it talks about the Four Noble Truths, the First Noble Truths. Truth is suffering. Jatipi dukkha. Yeah? Birth is suffering. Yeah? And here birth, as usual in the suttas, obviously means rebirth. Okay, the fact that when you were born in this life was suffering is meaningless from a spiritual point of view, right? You can't do anything about it. What it means is that being involved in that process of rebirth is suffering. Jatipi dukkha. Second noble truth, the ending, letting go of suffering, right? The origin of suffering, how do you let go of it? Yayang tanha pono bhavika, right? This is what gives rise to suffering. That craving which generates future rebirth, okay? So this teaching on rebirth is right at the core of the Buddha's experience of the Four Noble Truths. And he explained that very often in the suttas in terms of what we call the te vidya, the three knowledges. And those three knowledges are recollection of past lives, the knowledge of seeing the birth and rebirth of beings according to their karma, and finally the knowledge of arahantship or enlightenment, which is the ending of all rebirth. So these teachings on rebirth are fundamental to the Buddha's experience, and they're fundamental to his actual personal vision of the Dhamma. And this is something which he states again and again and again throughout the suttas, that these are not something that he has heard from anyone else. He's not teaching these because he's learnt it from somebody else. He's teaching it because this is what he's known and seen for himself. Right? So this argument that sometimes that the Buddha was sort of influenced by his cultural context and so on, this really doesn't hold water unless you have to assume that the Buddha was so stupid that he didn't understand that he was just mindlessly repeating cultural beliefs and mistakenly thinking that was his experience. If you think that the Buddha was so stupid, fine, but I don't know why you're interested in Buddhism, okay? Anyway, one of the things about this question of authority and the personal meditative experience of rebirth is this. The reliability and precision of your observations depend on the clarity of your instrument, right? If you're going to be a scientist, you want the best microscope to look through something, right? If you want to look at the stars, you want to go up and you want to use the Hubble telescope because that's the best. You want the best instrument, the most powerful, the most clear way of seeing. And it's the same thing in meditation. If you want to see the truth, you want the mind, right, which is the most clear and bright. And that mind is the mind of the fourth jhana in Buddhism. And when the Buddha talks about the recollection of past lives and the development of these experiential understandings, he always talks about it emerging from the clarity and depth of mind in the fourth jhana. And this is how it's described in the classic passage. His mind is thus concentrated in samadhi, pure and bright, unblemished, free from defects, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability. He directs and inclines it to the knowledge of recollecting past lives. So you can see that kind of knowledge is very different from, say, the spontaneous memories of a child, right? or something that might be recollected through hypnotic regression. Right? And so these are kinds of knowledge which are very vague, very uncertain, very unclear, and about which then you should be very sceptical. Right? But the knowledge that comes from very deep meditation, right, not just ordinary everyday meditation, but very deep meditation, because your mind is so clear, and particularly in the fourth jhana, because there's no pleasure and pain, there's very deep equanimity, right? So that objectivity, which is the goal of scientific observation, right, is present at an unparalleled level. You see clearly and undistorted. So it's that knowledge of rebirth, that personal knowledge, which is so powerful for the individual, and that's how the meditator learns to let go. Right? That's how the meditator sees these things so clearly with such conviction, and they can let go of those attachments that are going to lead to future rebirth. Now, if we're looking at, you know, cases of children or near-death experiences and things like that, we're not going to see it to the same depth, right? We're not going to have the same existential realizations about rebirth from this, right? This is what we're doing here is just preparation, right? We're just considering it, we're reflecting it, you know, we're looking at it. Maybe we might clear up some doubts. Maybe we might clarify the path a little bit, right? Maybe we might open the way to a deeper experience through meditation. But that's all it can ever be. The real thing is what you experience in meditation, and the test of that is, can you let go? There's a scholar called Thomas McEverly wrote a book called The Shape of Ancient Thought. I was just looking around for it earlier. I don't know if they have a copy here in the library. Have you seen a copy here? The Shape of Ancient Thought. You should put it on the to-purchase list. It's awesome. Yeah. Thomas McEverly, The Shape of Ancient Thought. Essentially what he does is he compares philosophy in ancient Greece and ancient India. That's the main focus of it. And one of the ideas that he puts forward is he notices that belief in reincarnation is very common all around the world. Many different cultures, many different places have these different beliefs in many different ways. Right? But he pointed out that there's only two places that share this particular complex of ideas around reincarnation that he called the reincarnation complex. And this is the first one is essentially the idea of samsara, right? That reincarnation is real and that it's not really real, but it's universal. It keeps on going on, right? Everybody gets reborn, right? It's not just certain specific individuals it happens to, and it doesn't just happen for once or twice, but it's an ongoing flow. That's what we call samsara. The second part of that complex is that rebirth is conditioned by karma, okay? That is your ethical choices is what conditions rebirth. Third one is that the aim of understanding that is freedom from that round of rebirth. Okay? Now these three beliefs are core to the teachings of Buddhism, Jainism, and also Hinduism. And they're also found in ancient Greece, in the various of the ancient Greek philosophers, in one form or another. Okay? And McEverly goes into a lot of those details. He's actually a lot better in his Greek philosophy than he is in the Indian philosophy. But this particular argument I found of his to be very persuasive. So he was interested in looking at the historical connections and asking whether this was a coincidence or whether there was a genuine historical connection between the development of these ideas, and he thought that there was. And that book is probably the most detailed examination of that question. Now, one of the things to notice about these three points is that they're separate. They don't have to belong together. And evidence for one of these points does not mean evidence for the rest of them. Okay? Now, just as I think in the skeptical sphere, sometimes people are too much in a hurry to throw doubt on some aspect of rebirth and say, therefore, the whole thing's rubbish. And I think we do the same thing within the Buddhist sphere. We tend to think maybe that there's something that confirms a certain aspect of rebirth, therefore, everything must be true, right? We're too eager to embrace the evidence. So we need to keep a little that sense of that critical distance. Okay? Now, I think that there is quite a lot of fairly strong evidence for the first point here, that reincarnation is real. And we'll be looking at those a bit later on. And I think there's actually quite strong evidence for that, and I think that's extremely important. There's a lot less evidence for the idea that reincarnation is universal. Okay? I mean, we have certain cases of people who can remember it. Does that mean that everybody had past lives? Well, it's not really, the evidence doesn't decide one way or the other. Similarly for karma, and this is something that's a bit inconvenient for Buddhism, unfortunately, right? Is that there's all these people who did all these terrible things and then get reborn in these quite nice lives in the next time, right? And so you're thinking, that's a bit awkward, right? So what's going on? What's up with that, right? So perhaps reincarnation is true, right? But karma is not, right? So you don't get reborn according to how you lived your life. You get reborn according to something else, maybe chance or who knows, right? However, remember that a lack of evidence is not an evidence of lack, okay? The reason why there's a lot less evidence for karma is because karma is a much more subtle thing, right? When we're talking about karma, we're talking about causality, right? What's the causal relationship between one thing or the other? And causality is always very hard to establish, okay? You think about, tobacco. Right? I mean, how many decades did that go through the courts and how many studies and things like that to prove that tobacco causes cancer, right? And, you know, you have millions and millions of people all around the world smoking every day, right? This huge pool of people, and still it's so very hard to really establish causality in a strong way. So we shouldn't be put off by the fact that the teaching on karma is less well established than the teaching on rebirth, right? That we should expect that. And in fact, the Buddha anticipated this in the Mahakamma Vibhanga Sutta, which we discussed in the last workshop. The Buddha says that there are cases where somebody does a good deed and they get reborn in a bad destiny, right? Why? Because it's complicated. Because they did some other good, bad thing some other time. And so they get reborn there. Somebody else does something bad, they go somewhere good. Because in their past, they also did something good. And we've all done many good things and many bad things. And so the way that conditions our rebirth is complex. And we shouldn't be in too much of a hurry to jump to conclusions from a small number of cases. Okay, so this is that word of caution, which we find through the suttas. Right? So the Buddha's epistemology was an epistemology of caution. Don't be in a hurry to jump to conclusions. And finally, the last one is that the aim of life is freedom. That when we realize this, that we should try to get liberated. Of course, that's a value judgment, isn't it, right? I mean, there's nothing that determines that. I mean, you might say, hey, I know I'm going to get reborn, and I know that a lot of those rebirths are going to be suffering, but, you know, it's life. I want to live it. Let me get reborn, right? So that's okay. It's not kind of right or wrong to say that you should be liberated or not. The Buddha's merely saying, pointing out cause and effect. He's saying, if you live like this, this is what will happen, yeah? And there is a possibility to do something else. So it's really up to you to say, you know, how you want to live and what that value is. Any questions on what I've said so far? Simon? Yeah. Hard to say. Yeah, I mean, personally, I think it would be implausible to argue that rebirth can be true for some people and not for others. I mean, I think in principle, I can understand that could be the case, but it doesn't strike me as being something you'd argue for very plausibly. Yeah, it's much more likely the evidence is just incomplete. Yeah, go on, Tana.
Memory of worm, you cut it in half and you get two worms. So it seems to me that it can, with some species, as far as I remember my biology. It leads me to reflect that actually the individual consciousness arises somewhere along the evolutionary pathway, and before then there is no even individual as such.
It seems likely, yeah.
Like it's kind of diffused.
That's right, yeah.
Cloud. I don't know, but that's what would make sense to me. Because if you look at the sponges and the blue bottles, and you have colonies,
Yeah.
Only the cells, and then they cooperate and becomes an organism.
Mm.
You know, when you look at the evolution from these eukaryotic cells to these colony organisms, and then you have organisms that have the nerve, so eventually the sense of I then probably just arises later on.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, the sense of I is not something which is unitary. It's not just one, is it? It's complex and it's always evolving and changing, you know. We were just talking earlier about the kind of the research and things like growing neurons from stem cells and things like that. So again, these are classic thought experiments, which actually may be medical experiments in the not too distant future. I mean, they just proposed in the paper a couple of months ago, somebody saying that they want to start researching doing full body transplants, otherwise known as a head transplant, depending on your point of view. All right. So, but imagine if you that one of the people at the conference going to be in August he's growing his own brain in a jar, right? His own neurons are being grown in a petri dish, right? Now, imagine if, you know, then it won't be too long, I assume, before that has genuine medical applications, right? Somebody has some brain damage, you can grow some more cells in the jar and replace it, right? Sounds good, yeah? How much can you replace? 5%? I think most of us would be okay with that. 10%? 50%? Could you replace half a brain with something that was grown in a jar? If you could replace half a brain, does that mean that you could replace both halves of your brain, right? So you split it out and you can have actually two brains, each of them with a replaced half. And then you are now two people, right? Yeah? Well, legally it would be an issue, wouldn't it? Yeah, it'd be an issue like in relationships and stuff, wouldn't it? Who are you married to? I mean, these are issues around identity, and I think from a Buddhist point of view, because we have this teaching of it's all not self, right? So self is a convention, and conventions are loose and slippery and impermanent, and they change. Yeah. Anyway, we had some other questions. I think Cindy, you had a question. Right.
Also, when they did the early heart transplants,
right,
people started, for instance, wanting things that where the heart came from.
Yes.
So
yes.
From their personality. So it's interesting that there is some connection there, or imprints on the physical nature.
Right. Exactly, and this is an interesting part of that physical thing, because often what happens is when people die, and this is actually a recognized practice in some cultures, right? Somebody dies, they'll actually make a mark on the body so that they can recognize the child when they're reborn. Okay? So they'll actually put some black or something like that on the corpse, and then when the child's reborn, then they'll have a birthmark in that spot. Yeah? Now that's, you know, again, interesting from the point of view of karma, because obviously that's not a karmic choice on the part of that person, right? But I think from the Buddhist point of view, you know, you have this idea of like nama rupa, or the mental and physical is always interrelated, right? So I think that those things can probably make an impression and make some difference, yeah? Which obviously has some kind of causal effect, but it's not like determining whether you have a good life or a bad life, right? It's just determining whether you have a birthmark or not. Yeah? So I think we shouldn't think that karma is the only thing that's conditioning rebirth. It's just that karma is the main thing which is conditioning our experience of happiness and sadness in the next life. Yeah. We had someone. Who else did we have? Do we have someone else? No. I thought we had another question. Okay. Let's do a few minutes meditation. This is still on the topic of authority, and I'll just briefly pass over, without going into any details, but briefly pass over some of the different sources for belief on rebirth apart from the Buddha. Obviously we have the different sages and so on in ancient India, but also in the West, Socrates, his dialogue Meno, talked about that. This, the question of rebirth was actually quite central to this and quite central to Socrates' teaching. And Socrates said in that dialogue, if there had been always true thoughts in him, both at the time when he was and was not a man, which only need to be awakened into knowledge by putting questions to him, his soul must have always possessed this knowledge, for he always either was or was not a man. So this is talking about, one of the crucial questions in philosophy is the question of epistemology. How do we come to know things? And in this dialogue, Socrates was trying to demonstrate how we come to learn things by questioning an unlettered slave boy. And he was in this dialogue and was going through with his slave boy and took him through a sophisticated proof of geometry. And this kid had never studied, he'd never learned anything, he didn't know anything about geometry, but he could grasp and understand intuitively all of the stages of the proof. And so Socrates is concluding that he must have had that knowledge inside him, right? It must have come from somewhere. Where has it come from? So it must have come from his past lives, right? His soul must always possess his knowledge. And so this is actually fundamental to Socrates' whole approach to knowledge and understanding, is that we know everything because we learnt it in our past lives. Right? And this, in fact, is where the Western notion of education comes from. We forget how influential these ideas were. We think education is something given, but it's actually something which is very rare. Why should we teach every person how to read and write, right? This is something that's actually only very recently in culture that this has come to be an idea, and the roots of it lie in the teachings of Socrates, and the roots of it lie in this specific idea. His idea is that we have knowledge and we can educe our knowledge, right? We can draw out our knowledge. That's what education means, to educe. In fact, it's the same as the Pali word vinaya. Vinaya means to draw out. Yeah? So to educe knowledge, we already have it. That's the job of education. Yeah? Unfortunately, that part of it seems to have been forgotten by most educationalists, who seem to think that their job is to bash knowledge into people's heads. Okay, but Socrates' idea was the kids already know the answers. Right? How do you draw it out of them? Yeah? It's very interesting. And it's interesting that you see the Buddha using the same methodology when he was teaching children as well. Yeah, the famous case of the Buddha talking to the kids who are tearing the legs off the crab, right? And instead of telling them, this is wrong, don't do it, he said to them, do you suffer? Yes, we suffer. Do you think that crab suffers? Yes, we think that crab suffers. Do you think that would you like it if somebody was to pull your legs off? No, we don't like it. Do you think the crab would like it when someone's pulling his legs off? No, we don't think so. And the Buddha is leading them step by step using what in Western philosophy they call Socratic method, okay? To draw out the knowledge that those kids already had, yeah? That's the basis of education in Socratic thought, and I think in Buddhist thought as well. And so here's just a few quotes from modern philosophers and scientists. Towards the end of her own storied life, the physicist Doris Kullmann-Wilsdorf, whose groundbreaking theories on surface physics earned her the prestigious Hain Medal from the German Society for Material Sciences, surmised that Stevenson's work, that's Professor Ian Stevenson, we referred to earlier, had established that the statistical probability that reincarnation does in fact occur is so overwhelming that cumulatively the evidence is not inferior to that for most, if not all, branches of science. Okay, that's a pretty strong statement made from a very experienced physicist. She's saying that the evidence for reincarnation is pretty much as good as the evidence for most, if not all, physical sciences. And, when we're not working in fields of science, we sometimes forget that there are, of course, many unanswered questions and unknown questions in different fields, okay? And no matter how sort of much scientists push back the barriers of knowledge, then of course there are many things which are unknown, many things which remain hypothetical. So, we get used to thinking in terms of like string theory or something like that as these are, physical hypotheses, and yet there's far, far less evidence for string theory than there is for reincarnation. Right? People have been spending billions and billions of dollars for decades trying to find evidence for string theory, and so far basically have come up with nothing. And yet with reincarnation, with far less effort, far less resources put into it, there's much more, I think, much more compelling evidence. Okay, Dr. Harold Leaf, Journal of Nervous and Mental Disorders, said either Ian Stevenson is making a colossal mistake, or he will be known as the Galileo of the 20th century. Another remark on Ian Stevenson. This is from the book review editor, Lester King, book reviewer of the Journal of American Medical Association. He has placed on record a large amount of data that cannot be ignored. And this is from Carl Sagan, who should need no introduction, astronomer and founding member of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. At the time of writing, there are three claims in the parapsychology field which, in my opinion, deserve serious study. The third being that young children sometimes report details of a previous life which, upon checking, turn out to be accurate and which they could not have known about in any other way than reincarnation. So again, it's quite compelling when you see people who are from a background in philosophy and physics and so on, who are skeptical in nature and critical in nature, and yet they admit that there is this kind of strong evidence which is present there. Of course, strong evidence doesn't mean that it's true. It just means that it's something that you should take seriously. Bernardo Kastrup, another modern philosopher, who's giving an interview here about these questions. And he talked about this scientific theory that consciousness is an emergent phenomenon. Okay, so this is the idea that your brain is a physical thing that develops and gets more complex, and at a certain level of complexity, somehow consciousness pops out on top of it. Okay, by means unexplained. And he says, and I think quite rightly, I think it's an appeal to magic. It's a label for something that we don't know or that we can't even conceive, to give it a label, and it sounds like we know because we give it a name. Yeah? And I agree with him very much in that assessment of that theory of the emergence of consciousness. To me, that's really just an admission that science isn't able to deal with consciousness, so we just sort of make up a word that will try to make it go away. So these are some of the thoughts on reincarnation from some authorities, ancient and modern. Of course, you could quote from many more. And at the end of the day, of course, it doesn't matter, right? Whether it's the Buddha who says it or some Carl Sagan or whoever, we should still look and investigate the evidence. But it is interesting to see that people who are intelligent and thoughtful have not always dismissed reincarnation. And here's just interesting also to look at the statistics, because it's sometimes said that reincarnation or rebirth is like an Asian thing, and that people believe it because of cultural beliefs in Asia and so on. But it's actually quite prominent in the West as well. These are just some statistics I pulled off Wikipedia. 22% of respondents to, this was a Gallup survey done in 2002, I think, or 2005 maybe. Anyway, whatever. 22% of respondents in Western Europe believe in reincarnation. Oh, this is a different survey, so the Western Europe one was a different one. According to 2005 Gallup poll, 20% of US adults believe in reincarnation. Recent surveys by the Barna Group, a Christian research non-profit organization, so you can assume that if anything they're going to have a bias against reincarnation, but they found that a quarter of US Christians, including 10% of all born-again Christians, embrace the idea. Okay, so that means that even people in places where it's culturally not sort of mandated, and where it's in fact against the teachings of your religion, right? Even then, significant numbers of people believe in reincarnation. When I taught a retreat in Germany a couple of years ago, there was about 30-something people on the retreat, nearly 40 people. And this question came up, and I asked people in the room who thinks that it's likely that there's something to the teaching on reincarnation. Who thinks that it's a plausible idea? Not you have to believe it, but you think it's plausible. And the interesting thing, in that whole retreat, everybody was European, and there was basically one Asian lady there. She was a Thai lady, huh? And every single person put up their hand to say that they believed in rebirth, except for the Thai lady. Yeah, she was the only one who didn't believe in it. Yeah. So this is why sometimes, you know, people say these things are culturally conditioned and so on and so forth. And a lot of that, to be honest, is just racist. You know, and I think that a lot of the attitudes that we find in these things, and some of the things I've read, in I find them shockingly racist, right? Well, we can't trust any of these reports of reincarnation from India because it's, you know, it's hardly a culture where critical thought is being valued, right? And so you basically, I mean, you read these things and you're like, seriously? And and people dismiss, they say, oh, a lot of these reincarnation cases come from Sri Lanka, therefore, you know, somehow we can dismiss it because they're Sri Lankan. I think this is terrible and very, very unscientific. The facts are that a lot of people believe in rebirth, so it's obviously something which is meaningful. Of course, that doesn't mean that it's right, okay? So a lot of people believe in very silly things, okay? We know this, okay? It does mean that I think what it means is that there's something. I think it means that it addresses something meaningful in our lives, right? It's something which is meaningful to people, even if whether it's true or not is a different question. But it matters somehow, right? I mean, why, if you're a born-again Christian in America, why would you believe in reincarnation, right? There's something about it that means something to you, right? It matters to your life. So, let's see. Okay, so the next one, we've got a few videos. And so these are embedded in here, so I don't have any control over them. So I'll just click them on and they'll play. And this is the first time that I've done a PowerPoint where I've got embedded videos, so I'm not exactly sure how it'll work. Anyway, we'll see if it works properly or not. But these are some different cases of reincarnation memories and so on and so forth. But the first one we're going to be looking at is a couple of cases of the savants. Okay, so these are children, young children who have extraordinary gifts. I don't know, are we right with the lights? Do we want to turn the lights off? Is that good? Right, I mean, this is one of the things, like with him, I mean, he's obviously amazing, right? And not only, you know, his playing, but also his the whole kind of technique and so on. But it's all show, right? It's very good show. It's like really good show. It's not just the showmanship, but also the way he's playing. And right, but with that girl who was before, to me as a musician, that was more impressive because there was no schooling, there's no technique. That was just her channeling music onto the keyboard, you know, and so, you know, with this kid, you know, the feeling I get is he's technically incredibly accomplished, and maybe he'd be a great musician if he found that. But to me, it's a different kind of skill, no less impressive, but yeah, different kind of thing. Yeah.
You don't know about this person's schooling.
No. He must have had schooling. Yeah.
To the Sorbonne at you know, 8 or something absurd, and he's also an incredibly famous concert pianist. But they say that music is actually processed in a different part of the brain. I don't know if this is true. And that's why even people at a very young age can remember whole songs, and why music goes so deeply into our consciousness, because it's processed in a different place in the brain and has a different, some sort of different biological function. Yeah. At a young age who have incredible dexterity in music, that switch that, when it's tripped, seems to enable him to have such skills. It's less obvious in other areas, such as drawing or other creative endeavours.
Mm.
Music seems to be the one.
Yeah. Come back to the point that I made before about that in some ways, like being a savant can be seen as being a lack rather than being an excess, right? It means that there's certain things that you're not doing. Sorry?
Other areas that are lacking.
There can be. I know that's the case in people suffering from like autism and so on, who can have great artistic abilities, but then you can give them all the schooling and so on, and they don't get much better. And I think this is sometimes can be the case with these savants, is that they have this native ability, but perhaps because, you know, it is an uneven development in their mind, right? And that real creativity comes from the struggle, right? So real artistic creativity comes precisely because it's difficult and you had to overcome things, right? And so maybe these people, where it's so fluent, it flows so easily, so that it's not the same sense of struggle behind it. Perhaps, yeah. Anyway, so again, this is just one of the kinds of things which have come out. I don't personally find that the evidence of savants is particularly compelling in the context of rebirth. I think it's certainly striking and interesting and intriguing. But as people have mentioned, I think there are a number of different possible explanations. And of course, the reality is we know so little about how the brain works and learning and so on that it's difficult to come to any particular conclusions. Before we break for our tea break, I'd like to play one or two more clips, short ones. And here, if I've got the order of them right and if I can remember them rightly, we're going to be going on to some of the cases of children who can remember their past lives. That's just to explain that. So this is the case of Dhamma Ruan. We heard his chanting a little bit beforehand, and I'd like to just take the time, because this is actually most of the kinds of evidence that we're going to be looking at are things which you can find on the web easily enough. But this is something which perhaps I haven't seen really discussed in detail, and I'd like to look at it from the point of view of a Pali scholar. And as you heard, one of the things that we noticed as Bhikkhu Bodhi and myself and Ajahn Brahmali were discussing this case, that we'd noticed that there were certain features in the Pali text. Now, when you hear Dhamma Ruan reciting, now you can hear that there's a sense of, you can get a feel for the flow of it, right? He knows what he's doing. He's not hesitating. There's a confidence. There's a natural rhythm to his words and all of those kinds of things. Of course, with due allowance for the fact the recording quality is quite poor, right? But if you know Pali, then you can easily listen to what he's saying and to know the exact readings that he's using. And you know that he's reciting, in fact, you know, word for word, literally, what the Pali texts say. And I'll just sort of demonstrate that here. So this is the Girimananda Sutta. And I'll just highlight the words for you. So you can hear from his chanting that he's clearly reciting, you know, literally the Pali text. He never makes mistakes, and he gets everything perfect all the time. But there's also some characteristics of his chanting which are unique. If many of you be familiar with this modern Sri Lankan chanting style, that of course is completely different to what he's doing here. But there's also differences in the details of how he enunciates the Pali. I'll just give you one example here. Listen to how he does these T's. Sankar Sasisami. You know, he goes T Sikkhati Sankara. Yeah, T Sikkhati. Yeah. Each time he does it, right? It's not a mistake. He like pauses on the T's. T Sikkhati. Yeah. And this is actually quite unusual. You don't hear that in modern chanting styles. If you look at the spelling of it, it's a short T. Right? And so we would always pronounce that in accordance with the actual spelling of it, right? Bhiti sangvedi asasisami disikati. So it's a short T, yeah? And he's always reciting it with a long T. But not even just an ordinary long T, but a slightly drawn out and paused long T, right? This is a mark which is marking the end of a quoted portion of text, right? It's in double quote marks, right? So it's natural that there's a bit of a pause, a bit of a break at the end of it. But when we recite Pali these days, we tend to do it quite mechanically, right? We sort of look at the phonetic representation of letters on the page and we reproduce that sound. But when he's reciting it much more like a natural language, right? Like he's somebody who's speaking that. He will always take a breath in a place in the sentence, which is a natural sentence break. You know, and again, you rarely hear that in modern chanting styles, right? People will usually just chant without taking a breath. Certainly in the Thai chanting style, you take a breath whenever you can. You don't take a breath on the natural breaks in the sentence, yeah? But he's like pausing in the right places, breaking it in the right places, giving emphasis in the words and all of these things. So it sounds much more like an actual natural language. I might come on to the Dhammacakka because there was a detail in the Dhammacakka which I wanted to point out. And just to reiterate the point that Bhikkhu Bodhi made in that thing, that many of the suttas which he recited were very long and obscure passages. Some of them are several hours long. There was quite a large body of recordings which were made. Only a few of them are publicly available these days. Actually, the originals of them, as a little detail in history, were kept at Santi Monastery for many years. Because of a connection between then Elizabeth Gorski, now Niroda, and the monk who was there at the time, Ajahn Ian, and Dhammaruan, and they sort of knew each other, and they kept the originals of many of those tapes there for a while. And so we've heard recordings, as Bhikkhu Bodhi mentions, of much longer passages. And many of these are not things that you could just pick up by just hearing monks chanting them around the place. This, of course, is one of the better-known ones, the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta. So just notice that difference there. So he came along and said, Dvayante pabhajitena na sevitabha, and then went straight on, Yo chayang kame sukama sukalikanu yoga. So this word phrase here means, so there are these two extremes that should not be practiced. What two? And then the Buddha goes on to explain what to. So actually the phrase what to is a little bit superfluous. It doesn't have to be there. So it's kind of dropped out, and that's a variant reading in that particular case. We'll just see. So this is the Pali Text Society version, and you can see that this doesn't have the katame dwe there. So this, the reading that we have in the main text here on Sutta Central is a Burmese text, and so that slightly different. His readings tend to be more similar to the Sri Lankan readings, which of course you'd expect. Different reading there. Okay, so when you listen carefully to the next sentence, Ayameva Ario Tangiko Mago Seiyati Dang. Listen to how he pronounces the Seiyati Dang. Okay, so you can hear he very distinctly pronounces it as two separate words, right? Seyati idang. So this is a feature known as sandhi in Indic languages, where you can join two words together. So grammatically, it doesn't make any difference how you pronounce it, but clearly he's pronouncing it as two separate words. Actually, often that would be a long I, so it's another variation. But the interesting thing about this one is that not only is it different from that text, he's also, if I got this correct, here's the same phrase here in the Pali Text Society edition. So this is more closely related to the Sri Lankan recension. Seyati dang, right? With one long I. The Burmese text has a short I. The Sinhala text has a long I with no variant readings mentioned here. Yeah? Whereas he was clearly pronouncing it as two separate words. Yeah? So in other words, he's pronouncing it in a way which actually isn't supported by any manuscript that we know of, right? I mean, of course, there may be others that we haven't tested. I haven't looked at this very widely. But this is the kind of thing I was pointing out to Bhikkhu Bodhi, that it doesn't look like, you know, where was he getting this text from, right? How is he doing it? Of course, in the Pali tradition, as the texts are passed down, there are these minute variations in the text which always creep in, right? No two recensions are the same, and we can trace the affiliation of a particular text, so we can look at it and know this is the Burmese one or this is Sri Lankan and what particular manuscript it comes from and so on, because of these small little variations in it. And from my little research, and I haven't looked at it in a lot of detail, but from what little research I've done, it seems that he's using a version of the Pali text which isn't the same as any of the printed editions that I've seen. So anyway, so this is Dhammaruan, and this is to me one of the most compelling cases I can't think of another plausible explanation for it other than from past lives. I don't think that you can be genetically programmed to recite like that. I don't think that he could have picked it up from people around him. I can't think of any other explanation. Yeah, and I didn't catch that. Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Importantly, though, the bio I read said that he was adopted by an extremely devout Buddhist.
That's the uncle
he's
talking about.
Yeah. But that could be significant in terms of knowledge. If you were skeptic.
One thing Ramadan said was that when we person in this image is very challenging for him as a child, he was always able to get him mixed out. And he said that it's really, really, you know, shaken him as a, you know, it's really difficult for people.
Right.
For a 3-year-old. He said, although they didn't say anything to my face, I knew they were looking at me suspiciously, so he didn't like it. And I think a lot of people who remember their past lives have this, you know, this, I don't want to give up, and he won't trust me, like,
mm.
So kind of
interesting, yeah.
So he said that clearly, and he didn't want to associate with it.
Yeah.
So it's not that he was going on, he couldn't help saying these, fighting.
Yeah.
Not that he was asked to view it, he just couldn't help doing it. Yeah. That's the understanding I got after using
it. Mm, interesting, yeah.
It's a strange thing, right? Like, Gittleton, a few weeks ago, he's apparently done a certificate in teaching meditation in America, which struck me as really bizarre. If he has this past life experience of being a monastic, it would seem, and he's gone off and done a course in teaching meditation.
Well, I mean, whatever. I mean, we've all done stuff in past lives, yeah? The fact that he's remembered it is, you know, it's unusual. But, you know, I'm sure we've all had different kinds of experience and so on. And as, of course, you know, you as with Dhammaruan, almost always, they forget, right? So when he's growing up, you know, he went through lots of different experiences in his life and then came back. So obviously there's an influence there, but it's not like he can sort of remember his past lives now and then, oh, yeah, this is how he used to meditate in those days. Yeah.
Yeah. Could we take a step back and explain the methodology behind looking at young children? So all of the cases that I've read about and in Stevenson's research and Godwin's research.
Yeah.
And even these savants are looking at young children. So I could the kind of reason for that. The reason you just articulated was that we forget as we get older.
Mm.
But why should children be given? Is it just because the patterns should be stronger because they're closer? Or
I think so, yeah.
Is there another explanation because they're not polluted by...
I don't think so. I think it's just that I think... I mean, from the point of view of rebirth, if we were to assume that, you know, explain it from the point of view of rebirth, you'd say that when you come through to this lifetime, mostly we forget stuff, right, for whatever reason, but mostly we forget stuff. In some cases, it seems in not a small number of cases, then kids will remember things, but they don't remember a context or something. It's just bits and pieces of things that sort of break through more or less, that seem more or less random, right? I mean, presumably there's some reason for it, but we don't actually see that. And so these are like patterns which occur in your life. But I think that, I think that this is actually the tip of the iceberg of a much bigger phenomenon. My personal belief is that this is the tip of an iceberg of a much bigger phenomenon. This is something I was going to address later on in the workshop. And I actually think that a lot of the things that we learn as kids actually come from past lives in one way or another, like, say, picking up language. Right? And we do that all the time. And the only reason we don't think that that's extraordinary is because we've all done it. Yeah? But actually, I think it's just as extraordinary as anything that these kids are doing. The difference, I think, is that language is useful, right? So it's reinforced behavior and it's cultivated, and so it's something that there's the capacity for it, and we develop it in this life, so we keep on being good at it. Whereas these kind of, you know, past life memories and so on, they're not very useful. I think that really that's the reason why they just fade away, because they're not being kind of reinforced and developed. Maybe there would be a way of cultivating it through, I don't know, either talking with them or hypnosis or therapy or meditation, something I don't know, that might enable kids to actually maintain the memories as they get older. Yeah. another little video. And this one here, we're starting to look at the stories of the children with the different memories. And this is one which is very well known. And this is the boy who was the fighter pilot. So, where are we now?
Okay. 11-year-old James Leininger looks and acts like most boys his age, but beneath his playful spirit is a very deep soul.
I said, you know, I'm really glad you're my son. And
okay. So that's one of the stories which I think is very, very powerful one, and a number of aspects of it. This is one of the books, one of the stories which was investigated by Jim Tucker, and Jim Tucker, of course, took over from Professor Ian Stevenson's work. So even though there we have like a popular account through Fox News, but Jim Tucker sort of goes into quite a lot of detail as to, you know, how the stories were told and so on. It's a remarkable and I think a very special example of the reincarnation stories for a number of reasons. Most obvious reason being that we're in time, right? We can actually talk to the kid while he's still remembering those things and actually have the footage of the events as it unfolds. And that's very unusual. Usually it's much later that we hear about it and it's told and retold. So to actually see it and to actually see firsthand, you know, those emotional responses that the kid has, you know. I mean, I could feel it myself when you see him over that boat and they're coming to that place. I mean, there's something genuinely happening there. This is not just a made-up story. And as well as the sort of the very detailed sort of recollections and details of things like the memories, the family names, the squadron names and so on. And that's only a few of the things which was in that little clip. There's actually many more specific details which were about that. You know, there was one, if I remember rightly, where he saw a picture of the plane that he was supposed to be flying and he just sort of said, oh, the antenna's on the wrong side. And they're like, you know, what are you talking about and so on. But then it turns out that they'd actually modified the planes that they were using on that aircraft carrier so that the antenna was on the other side of it. And, you know, these are so many specific details, not just once or twice, but over and over and over again. And you can see also his confidence in talking about it, you know. It's just so matter of fact. This is just what happened, you know. So the other thing that's interesting about that is, and this is actually quite common in these, in our discussion group, the question was raised, is there a confirmation bias? And this is something which you hear from the skeptics again and again and again, confirmation bias. And what they don't acknowledge is that in most cases, actually the parents don't want this to be a reincarnation thing. And they actually try to shut it down and they try to ignore it. Yeah? And these are, you know, Christians from America. The last thing they want is for their kid to be spouting on about these Buddhist beliefs, right? But it's just the reality. So there are many cases like this where people are actually compelled by what's happened against their own presuppositions and their own quite deeply held beliefs. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So what would that time gap be between him being shot down and being reborn?
Quite a few decades, yeah. So
it's still so it's so fresh, the memory.
Yep. It's interesting, isn't it, yeah? And it's one of the, again, thing that was raised in our discussion group, but it does seem that there's a fairly large proportion of these cases where they had some kind of violent or traumatic death. It's difficult to say because we don't have a random sampling, right? You've only got the cases that come to attention. And maybe it's just that the cases which kids talk about more are the traumatic ones. So they're the ones that manifest in behaviour. So that's the ones you get recognised. It's a bit hard to say. But certainly you do seem to find a lot of cases where you know, kids have died. That particular one of someone dying as a pilot in the war or something, there's a number of similar cases. In fact, there was one in a group I was talking with in Sydney a couple of years ago. We were talking to a group with one of the Sri Lankan families, and there was about 15, 20 people there. And the question came up, and I just asked them, is there anybody here who's had this kind of experience? And then somebody said, sort of very kind of sheepishly said, well, actually, my brother was one of Ian Stevenson's cases. And he had actually been, had all of these memories of being a pilot in the Second World War, shot down, and he was, you know, born and brought up in Sri Lanka, but basically liked everything British, right? He liked English tea and English everything and couldn't stand Sri Lankan food and all of this stuff. And what was interesting about that was that I was driven home after that talk by one of the people there. And when we were driving home, he said to me, Bhante, he'd known that family his whole life. Yeah, he was born in the same village. He was their neighbours and grew up beside them. Huh? And nobody had, he had no idea that this had happened. Nobody had ever mentioned anything about this to him before. Yeah? And he said, but even though he'd never known anything like that, it was so obvious that that brother was just totally different to everybody else in the family. Yeah? He was just like a white man, you know, growing up in a Sri Lankan village, and now he's off living in America or something like that. So, yeah.
Fancy the trauma is between those decades.
Right. The gap. Seems so. Yeah, it seems so. I think, and it's just my supposition, is that I think that process of rebirth, because it's a complex process, it can happen in different kinds of ways, right? I don't think it always takes the same amount of time or something like that. But I think when it's an unsettled process, it maybe take longer, right? Always, I think the best analogy for rebirth is moving home. Yeah, this is the metaphor that the Buddha used, right? So moving home. So it's like moving home. So if you're kind of together, right, and you've got a decent job and everything like that, and you decide, I want to move into a better home for such and such a reason, and you sort out your financing, and you go and you find the place and all of that kind of thing, then you can move home quite quickly, right? One weekend, you get the removalists, you're in there, right? But then maybe that doesn't happen, right? Maybe the opposite happens, right? Suddenly your partner leaves you, you go to work that day, you lose your job, all your financing falls through, and then you're out, and your life's fallen apart, and you're trying to crash at a friend's place or go back to your parents, and you're lost and you're wandering around. It might take you years before you've actually settled down in a new home. Yeah? So it really kind of depends on how that thing happens. So in these kinds of cases, it seems, at least in this case, he died. And then somehow what happened between, we don't know. There's a state of confusion or loss or something. Yeah. Another possibility, yeah. I mean, you'd kind of imagine that why would his memories of that life be so vivid if he'd been born somewhere else? But look, it doesn't mean it can't happen. Could have been up in another planet. Yeah. From his sense of like the emotional connection when he went there, right? That's my feeling. And again, this is just a supposition, but my feeling is that, yeah, you died and there's like a confusion. You don't know what's happened. And you're like, you know, so there's a kind of attachment to that place. There's all these unresolved issues which are still there. And, you know, you could see that the difference in those drawings that he was making. You know, again, this is really showing that there's a change that's happened. Yeah. And I think this is something which we should acknowledge is one of the reasons for talking about this, you know, because I think people do have these kinds of experiences. And if they feel that they can't talk about it, they feel that it's just weird, no one will understand, then it's going to be lonely and isolating and confusing. Yeah. But simply the fact to say it's normal, you can talk about it, I think is a good thing in itself. Mm. Popes have a habit of doing that kind of thing, don't they? Yeah.
I seem to remember, I can't tell you years or when it happened, but I heard
That's right. They say that the Nicene Council about the 4th century or something that happened. It's a slightly controversial topic, and there are different views on it, of course, as there are with anything in religious history. But yeah, I mean, I would agree. It seems to me very likely that in the Bible, in a number of places, and also in the early church fathers, that there was quite widespread belief in rebirth. Remembering, of course, that rebirth was normal among the Egyptians, it was normal among the Greek philosophers, and it was normal among the Indian philosophers, with which they were having a massive international trade at the time. So it's not as if it was a kind of unknown, marginal belief. Yeah. Okay, so we move along. Let's have a look at another story. This is one from England, if I remember the order of things correctly.
Nicola was born in Yorkshire, England. When only 2 years old,
this is not,
surprised
not you.
That
no.
The life of another time seemed to be clear and deep, but her mum was sceptical.
She went on and on about this for the ages. And then we were watching a film and like Nicola stood up called The October Man. And at the end of it, John Mills had a bit when he put herself under this chain knot. And as it were getting nearer to it, chapel coming nearer, chain were coming nearer. And she just stood up, started moving her arms out and gasping for breath. And I said to him, she's taking a fit, you know, what's up with her? She had a bit of tunnel, so we turned it off in 5 or 10 minutes, she was alright. Because she knew that if we threw herself under that chain, what was going to happen.
Can you translate for us, Nicola?
At the sight of someone approaching railway tracks, Nicola began to panic. Kathleen asked her daughter if she could remember both where she lived and the name of her previous family. Though Nicola couldn't remember her own previous Christian name, she remembered that her father's name was Thomas Benson, and that she had a mother and
so
two
that's
sisters.
That's the story of Nicola, who got... does it look like Nicola? I looked at this and I thought... No. Yeah? So again, I like that story. I mean, there's many of these cases, and that one is also an nice one because, again, you get to see the actual girl herself. It's not as dramatic as the one with James Leininger, obviously, but I also really like the spirit of her mother, you know, and her mother was like, she's really kind of quietly spoken and stuff like that, but she's also like, take no nonsense, and when they're trying to say, don't look at the records because we don't believe in this reincarnation stuff, and she's like, I'm going to go and look at them. And to me, that's that really good attitude, huh? So that's very much the kind of that spirit of inquiry, yeah? So actually find out, don't take it on faith, so just believe it. Is it true? Is it not true? You find out. You ask. And like the James Leininger question, it's not a question of there being a confirmation bias. It's a question of there being a strong bias the other way, right? You're having to overcome your reluctance to believe these things. And it's not just in the cases in the Western world that's true. It's also very commonly, very normally the case even in Asian countries where the parents are kind of a bit freaked out or a bit, you know, confused by it all, they don't understand it, it's disturbing and so on. So, yeah.
There's a piece missing from the story that Alan read.
Okay.
Because the researchers looked up the family in the census, at that time there would have been the death record also, and one wonders why that hasn't been pulled out. That's
yeah. Yeah, I noticed that as well. You're right. It'd be interesting. I haven't looked at it in more detail. It'd be interesting to look at the case in more detail. Yeah, whether they'd done that. And I wasn't clear whether did they find a birth record? I know they thought there was a birth record and then the census where she didn't appear in the census. Okay, but they didn't find it. Well, it wasn't mentioned about the death record anyway. So, yeah, presumably, yeah. So, yeah. But this, it's also an even more dramatic case of a gap in time, isn't it? It's more than 100 years in this case. Yeah. Okay, well, I'll tell you a story, and again, this is just a story, so I'm not going to vouch for it or anything, but to me, it kind of makes sense. Okay, there was a Western fellow who visited Thailand in the late 1960s, early 1970s, whose name was can't remember his name. The name was Dr. Somebody. He wrote there's a Buddhist Publication Society leaflet by him, I think, called Nibbana and Anatta or something like that. Anyway, maybe it might come to me. And he was apparently quite an extraordinary person, right, in different ways. And he came to Ajahn Chah's monastery. And was quite interested in Buddhism and interested in Dhamma and things like that. But he wasn't just, you know, a Dhamma practitioner. There were various kinds of rumors about him being involved with maybe CIA, various kinds of colorful activities and things like that. Then he disappeared, okay, in the south of Thailand. He was on some trek, walking through the jungle, something like that. Disappeared. It was the time there was insurgency and so on in the south of Thailand. No one knew what happened. There was an extensive search for him. The royal family got involved, helicopters, all of these kinds of things, and they never found anything, never found a trace. Again, according to the story I heard, many years later, about 20, 30 years later, a monk who shall remain anonymous went to Bangkok and visited one of the Ajahns there who had a reputation for being able to see, you know, past lives and all of these kinds of things. So he went to see him, and one of the things he asked him was about this fellow. He said, "What happened to him?" And this monk sort of went into, according to the description of it, this monk sort of goes into samadhi while he's still chewing his betel nut. So he's sitting there chewing his betel nut, and he's like going ding, 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 up and down through all the different realms of existence and checking for him and stuff. And then he sort of comes out and says, he's not anywhere, you know, are you sure you've got the name right? And he says, yeah, that's who it is. And so he says, let me look again, right? So again, he goes into samadhi. And again, so the story goes that he sort of sent his consciousness and found where the consciousness of that person who departed was. And he was still in the jungle, right, where he had died. And what had happened was that he was walking through there by himself or something like that, and he'd been shot. And it had just been like a bullet that had come out of nowhere, right? So there were various insurgents, communist insurgents in the jungles at that time. And so he just got hit from the back of the head and just died instantaneously. And his consciousness was completely confused. He didn't know where he was or what he was doing or anything like that. And so he just sort of stayed in this null state for all those decades, not doing anything and not able to move on. But then when this monk projected his consciousness there, and this fellow knew he was there, somehow he saw him, or he knew that this other monk was there, and he realized that this was a monk, and he remembered his faith in the Dhamma, right? And because he had the faith in the Dhamma and he had the joy in the Dhamma from recognizing this monk, so his mind became clear, and then he was reborn in went to a heaven realm or something like that. So again, what can I say? It's a story, take it or leave it. But to me, that kind of makes sense in terms of understanding how, you know, how these traumatic and unexpected deaths happen. You know, you're just lost. You don't know what you're doing. You're just in a confused state. And until something happens, maybe a trigger or something like that, and then you can sort of get your focus back and move on. But that's what I think. It's just a state of confusion, really.
Maybe if you don't go down the tunnel, you know, there's that
Right.
Everyone reports those who had near-death experiences going through the tunnel, being met by, you know where you're going, things just
right.
happen. But if there's none of that, you're just awareness continuing, you wouldn't
right.
have anything to register it by.
That's right, yeah. Don't they? Ah, yeah, yeah. Depending where you are, yeah, yeah, for sure, yeah.
You know, the wars and countless wars and tsunamis and physical, how many millions of beings, therefore, won't be around in this computer state? And if we had compassion for them, what would we do?
Sorry? Well, I mean, traditionally, people, this is what people do, the offering and transferring of merit for beings like that. Yeah.
Should they do their one here next to me? And
hang on. Right, because there's a sense of location and place and everything, yeah.
And although we can't see them ourselves,
yeah.
We might become aware of the poltergeist movement, but doesn't it then say that there is a physical dimension to the...
Poltergeist?
Poltergeist?
Poltergeist. Yes. Not to the soul, but to the... Oh, to the soul, sorry. Yeah, pardon. Yeah. Yeah, to the consciousness, yeah. Yeah. Well, is gravity physical?
We can measure it.
You can measure it?
Yeah.
Can you measure it for me now? Okay, very good. You beat me. Ah. Okay, so that's true. So there are effects, but there are other things that are around us that are hard to measure, right? So the fact that something's physical, I think, should mean that in principle it's possible to measure it. Think of something like dark matter or something like that, or what are those other things, positrons or things like that. They're actually very hard to measure, but they're still, in principle, you'd think impossible. It should be possible in principle to measure it. Yeah. Maybe. Maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
In Chinese Buddhism, the concept of merit, the path of one, is one of the purposes exactly that. So, one of my relatives, mother-in-law, passed away. And when some of the children went to the temple, the Taoist priest told them that your mother is still floating around and not properly born yet.
Right.
And one way to measure it is you donate how many books in Buddhism.
Okay.
And that's one way of transferring the merits. So we did that in 1 year. And then we got in touch with the priest again and said, not bad, but we need some more time.
Uh-huh. It's the gift that keeps on giving, yeah.
So whether you're a skeptic to think that's the way the temples get more books from it, whether you actually believe it and everybody is more at peace because we have helped the wandering soul.
Yeah. I mean, I think that those practices are very good because they're one of the biggest... psychologically, one of the biggest problems when you have death or bereavement in the family is people feel helpless. You know, that's that loss. So actually, you give people something positive to do, and so I think that's really useful. Yeah. Yeah.
I have an experience which I'd like to share.
Please. Okay.
And she had been told by her mother that her father
Okay. Okay.
She had no contact with any of her father's family at all. We thought it was probably in the late 40s at the time. But she decided that what she would do was to research the family and find out more, and went into archives to find out if there were any documentation about his death, etc., etc. She did a lot of research, probably over a 2-year period, finding more and more about her father.
Mm.
And on one occasion in my office in the city, it was a kind of late appointment, and she had a box that she had been given by an aunt that she found, and in the box were things belonging to her father. And in the box were things that her father had kept from her, so there was like a booty for when she was a baby, and some photographs of her with her dad at a picnic on the beach. They were very nice memories, because when her mother and father had split, she only had minimal contact with the father, and the father obviously kept all his So we were talking about these things that belonged to her father, and she was quite emotional at the time, and listening to her, and I said to her, remind me, how old were you when your father died? And then there was a voice, which was not my voice, it was not her voice, that said, you were 9 when I died. And we both looked at each other, and she said, did you hear that? I nodded. And she felt at that time as if that was her father speaking. I don't know what you think about that.
Wow.
I've gone all goosey.
That would be an interesting therapy session. What can I say? You probably both need extra therapy afterwards. Okay. Exactly. That's a good point. Yeah. Sure, yeah.
He discovered in her research, because he had been to a pub now, whether he'd been drinking or late, and he'd been discovered. And it was very much a bit like the one punch stuff that you're now talking about. He'd been discovered, he'd been hit, and he fell over and hit his head on the gutter and died almost instantly.
I don't believe in those spots of lights. You can buy simple mechanical devices that will make them go away. Yeah.
But the Buddha talked about spirits
and yes, but not as much as you might think. Yeah. It talks about rebirth and so on in suttas quite a lot. But if you look closely at the suttas, most of the times what it's actually talking about is sort of devas appearing and things like this. Usually it's in part of a background narrative. It's not something that the Buddha himself is actually saying. So this is one of the things that we use in terms of distinguishing how reliable a text is. If something is actually attributed to the Buddha, it's more likely to be sort of preserved carefully, whereas the background narratives are sort of handled more loosely and more playfully. But yeah, it's true that there are these things found in the suttas, yeah. Again, that's just a commentarial story, right? So there's 1,000 years between the sutta and that story. Yeah. Yeah. exactly, which are all in the background narratives. Yeah, so the verses where the Buddha himself is talking, then usually it doesn't refer to the devas. Occasionally it does, but usually they're just like verses of Dhamma, which could be anywhere, right? They could be in any kind of context. So there's just like a narrative framework for those verses. Yeah. Again, I'm not trying to say that they didn't happen or anything like that. I'm just saying that from a textual point of view, that we make that distinction between those things that the Buddha himself said and those things which are the narrative which gives a framework for what the Buddha said. And when we compare the different versions, we almost always find that the things which are attributed to the Buddha himself are preserved the same in all the different versions, whereas the narrative frameworks are much more looser and there's much more variation in them, so that they clearly weren't preserved as carefully in the tradition. Yeah. Okay, so let's move on. We'll have more chance to discuss these personal things later. Now, there's the next video, which I'll just click through in a minute. The way this works is they automatically start playing when I click through. But the next one is quite a long one, so I think we'll have to skip over that. But that's actually a longish interview with Professor Stevenson himself. So this is available online. It's about 20 or 30 minutes, so I think it's too long for us to watch now, but it's a really good one to have a look at, and he sort of goes, he's very kind of cautious, very careful and very methodical, and this is where he talks about some of the cases where people have the biological connections between the past life and this life. So this is just, I'll just play a couple of minutes of this just to get a sense of it.
Would show you some of the things that these young children may say. This is by no means a complete list, but such remarks as, when I was big, I was an airplane pilot. They may fill it out in different ways. The rejection of the mother, the disparagement of the immediate surroundings of the child, and something about what the child claims to have done previously. Let me show you and tell you briefly about one case to give you a kind of feel subsequently discovered.
Okay, so as I said, I won't go through the whole of that thing. That would take up the rest of the session, but very recommended to have a look and see Ian Stevenson discussing it himself. And you can get a bit of a sense of his personality there. He's obviously quite a dry professor type, very far from being a New Age woo-woo character. He's very much concerned with, getting the evidence, sorting out things and making sure everything's clear as possible. Moving on from the discussion of the children with past life memories, I want to briefly talk about a couple of other kinds of evidence for rebirth before going on and briefly touching on the arguments of the skeptics. So I want to talk about near-death experiences just a little bit without going into too much details. Near-death experiences, I think, are quite well known. I don't think I have to describe about what happens with a near-death experience. But they have certain limitations as evidence for rebirth, right? First thing is, of course, it's very difficult to actually establish anything independently or to prove anything independently, right? What happens when somebody dies? There are various attempts to explain near-death experiences by different physical phenomena. One well-known explanation was in terms of oxygen deprivation. And they did these experiments with fighter pilots at high G and this kind of thing. One I heard yesterday, somebody mentioned something about toads. There's a chemical in toads or something like that, which has the same chemical in that you have when you're having a near-death experience. And if you, whatever, inject or smoke or whatever that same chemical, while you're doing your toad smoking, then you get that same chemical and you have a near-death experience. Sorry? You have to lick the toads. Yeah. I mean, I could understand how that just happened by accident, because you just sort of casually licking the toad and okay, so and it's very rare to find verified claims, right? So the kind of the smoking bullet for this kind of case is where you have somebody who's sort of verifiably dead, right, actually brain dead, and then something happens while they are brain dead, right, that you can later, that they will remember and be aware of, okay? This is the smoking bullet to know if, you know, somebody's died and they can say, you know, 5 minutes past four, their brain ceased operation, right? 8 minutes past four, the surgeon said such and such to the nurse, okay? Then later on they were revived and they were able to remember that exactly that thing that the surgeon said, right? So this is the kind of the gold standard. It's very hard to do that because it's hard to establish exactly time of death and so on. And but there are a number of cases where those kinds of things seem to have happened. Some of them have been discussed in quite some detail. I might just zip over to that. One of these was in a PDF. I couldn't get it into the slideshow, but this gives a couple of the cases. This is a discussion of just a few incidences of that kind to give you an example of what it's. So here are some examples which are mentioned in this paper. So this is paper, you should know where it's from. Further evidence for veridical perception during near-death experiences. And this is in the Journal of Near-Death Studies from, here we go, case number one. In 1985, Kathy Milne was working as a nurse at Hartford Hospital. She'd been interested in near-death experience and one day found herself talking to a woman who'd been resuscitated and who had had an NDE. Following a telephone conversation with me, she described the following account in a letter. She told me how she'd floated up over her body, viewed the resuscitation effort for a short time, and then felt herself being pulled up through several floors of the hospital, which must be kind of weird, going through the hospital floors. Then she found herself above the roof and realized she was looking at the skyline of Hartford. She marveled at how interesting this view was. Right? I think that's one of the kind of realistic details, right? You've just died, right? You've just proved the existence of life after death and something. Oh, it's a nice view, isn't it? I haven't seen the city from here before. Huh? And out of the corner of her eye, she saw a red object. It turned out to be a shoe. She thought about the shoe and suddenly she felt sucked up a blackened hole. The rest of her NDE was fairly typical. I was relating this to a skeptical resident who, in a mocking manner, left. Apparently, he got a janitor to get him onto the roof. When I saw him later that day, he had a red shoe and became a believer too. Yeah? So that's very interesting. There actually was a red shoe on the roof, and even the skeptic found it. One further comment about this second white crow. So you know what the white crow is? Presumably? No? This is a classic logical sort of example, right? All crows, if you make a statement, all crows are black, all you need is one white crow to prove that statement incorrect. Yeah? So this is the case with near-death experiences and so on. If you want to establish the hard materialist thesis that the brain is, sorry, that the mind is an emergent property of the brain, all you need is one case, one example where the brain cannot be producing the mental phenomena, and that's your white crow. You've immediately disproved that thesis. Okay. Again, in the form of a single and probably situated shoe. After my initial interview with Milne, I made a point of inquiry with if she'd ever heard the case of Maria's shoe. So there's another case discussed earlier. Not only was she unfamiliar with it, but she was utterly amazed to hear of another story so similar to one she had recounted for me. It remains an unanswered question how these isolated shoes arrive at their unlikely perches for later viewing by astonished NDEers and their baffled investigators. Okay. Case number two. In the summer of 1982, Joyce Harmon, a surgical intensive care unit nurse at Hartford Hospital, returned to work after a vacation. On that vacation, she'd purchased a new pair of plaid shoelaces, which she happened to be wearing on her first day back at the hospital. That day, she was involved in resuscitating a patient, a woman she didn't know, giving her medicine. The resuscitation was successful, and the next day, Harmon chanced to see the patient, whereupon they had a conversation, the gist of which, not necessarily a verbatim account, is as follows. The patient, on seeing Harmon, volunteered, "Oh, you're the one with the plaid shoelaces." "What?" Harmon replied, astonished. She says she distinctly remembered feeling the hair on the back of her neck rise. I saw them, the woman continued. I was watching what was happening yesterday. When I died, I was up above. So again, this kind of case. So these are examples where people have apparently known things which they shouldn't have known. But of course, it's difficult to rule out. Is it just coincidence? Did she see it another way? Were they really dead at the time? So it is difficult to establish these things. But let's have a look at another case. In the late 1970s, Sue Saunders was working at Harford Hospital as a respiratory therapist. One day she was helping to resuscitate a 60-ish man in the emergency room whose electrocardiogram had gone flat. Medics were shocking him repeatedly with no results. Saunders was trying to give him oxygen. In the middle of the resuscitation, somebody else took over for her and she left. A couple of days later, she encountered this patient in the ICU. He spontaneously commented, "You look so much better in your yellow top." She, like Harmon, was so shocked at the remark that she got goosebumps, for she had been wearing a yellow smock the previous day. "Yeah," the man continued, "I saw you. You had something over your face and you were pushing air into me. Then I saw your yellow smock." Saunders confirmed that she had something over her face, a mask, and that she had worn the yellow smock while trying to give him oxygen while he was unconscious and without a heartbeat. So these are some of the examples giving some, I think, some credence to this the near-death experiences. But like I said, I don't personally find them as compelling as the cases of the verifiable children's memories. But there are other cases as well, and there are some which I think are quite persuasive. And I'm not saying I disbelieve in them; I just don't find them to be such strong evidence. Yeah. Anyone here had a near-death experience? No. Okay, so next one, I think about learning. This is an interview with Noam Chomsky. I'll just read through this first. So the interviewer, of course, you know Noam Chomsky, right? The great linguist, one of the most famous intellectuals in the 20th century. And the interviewer asks him, "So we're faced with a mystery. How could anyone possibly learn enough about the English language to possess the rich and exotic grammatical knowledge that we all seem to possess by the time we are 5 or 6 years old?" I just say it seems a bit kind of biased that he says English language because learning other languages is so easy. But actually they just had sort of previous discussion about particular grammatical questions in English, so this is why they're talking in that context. Chomsky then replied, "There's an obvious answer to that. The knowledge is built in. You and I can learn English as well as any other language with all its richness because we are designed to learn languages based on a common set of principles which we may call universal grammar." Now, this is a linguistic theory which Chomsky had and which, you know, is something that really should be taken seriously. Chomsky was the foremost linguist of the 20th century. He attributed this innate knowledge of deep grammar to biology, right? He was a materialist philosopher. And he would attribute it to genetics and to selection and so on, which may be the case. But to me, this is interesting because I think it's a specific example of something which I think is a more general thing, which is how we actually learn, right? And how we grow up as kids and we develop and we learn incredible amounts of things. And what Chomsky's pointing to, you know, the examples Chomsky's been looking at, one of the things he points out is that there are cases in English grammar which are so rare that you're unlikely to ever encounter them, right? So kids will grow up and they're unlikely to actually know these things, but when they're presented with them, they will know that this is correct grammar or this is incorrect grammar. Yeah, so it's not just that you actually pick things up from around you. And there are all these things in how fast children learn, how well children learn and so on, that seem incomprehensible, or seem, anyway, this is Chomsky's conclusion, was that we can't explain language acquisition merely by the immersion of children in their environment. There must be something else. There must be something that's a predisposition to know. So, like I said, he would attribute that to biology and genetics. Another explanation, as we saw the Socratic explanation, was that we know things from our past lives. So I think this is an interesting one, and for me, I feel that kids, like babies, they're people. And I don't think they're people because of genetics and environment. I think they're people because of consciousness. And they're already people when they're born, right? I mean, they're not fully formed and they can't express it clearly and all of those things, but when they come, they're already someone, you know? They already have some kind of personality and they already have all of these things which are there. And I think that these things come from, personally, I believe these things come from past life. There was a study done on, I don't have the details of it here, but I read it some time ago, a prenatal study done on identical twins in the womb. And so they studied it and they found that, this was done by an Italian researcher, and she found that even identical twins in the womb will have different behaviours. So typically one might be more active and one might be more passive. And that those behaviours are still reflected through their life. And so the one which is more active will end up being more extroverted. The one which is more passive will end up being more introverted or something like that. These are the patterns that they found. And so this kind of example, it becomes very difficult to explain it. I mean, they have basically identical genetics, identical environment. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe there might be another explanation. Like all of these kinds of evidence, there's nothing which is definitive. But to me, it's very suggestive. And I think that personally, it feels to me like people are born as people. And yes, genetics contributes, environments contributes, and all of those things. But they're not the full story.